You're listening to the Community Character Hour. We begin each episode with a newspaper clipping from the past. And what have we got today, Hannah?
Well, this month we don't actually have a newspaper clipping because we're talking about a period of time during which there were no newspapers in North Idaho and, in fact, very few written records. So instead, we're going to share an excerpt from the Preface to the Illustrated History of North Idaho, published in 1903, which was one of our key sources for compiling information for this episode. So the authors of this North Idaho history written in 1903 say, "The accuracy and completeness of such a work depend not alone on the conscientiousness and care of the compilers, but more especially upon the amount and quality of the materials which happen to have been preserved. For months, the editorial force of the company has been searching with zeal and avidity for everything which could possibly throw light upon the past and present of Nez Perces, Idaho, Latah, Kootenai, and Shoshone counties. Their search has not been as successful as they could wish, but they have done the best they could under the circumstances. It is thought that practically all printed matter which directly or indirectly relates to the subject has been examined. Where no contemporaneous printed accounts could be found, the editors have been compelled to rely upon the testimony of pioneer settlers who took part in the events which they relate. In such cases, they have, when possible, verified the statements of one man by those of another, knowing how treacherous and deceptive the memory frequently proves. But with all vigilance, we cannot feel sure that erroneous statements have not crept into the volume, and we feel constrained to invoke the kind charity of the reader to the faults he may discover." So I felt that this this opening that they use in this book, which is just wild to me that they wrote a history of North Idaho in 1903. Mm-hmm. But it felt fitting because I feel like we need to make the same preface to this show.
we're talking today about, we'll get into what we're talking about today. But yeah, history is always a challenge, isn't it? You're at the whims of what people at the time chose to write down, chose to preserve, and that's what we learn. This is the Community Character Hour. I'm Jack Peterson. I'm joined, as always, by Hannah Combs, whose voice you just heard. She's the executive director of the Bonner County Historical Society and Museum, and also by Heather Upton, who is back here on microphone 3 after a short absence. Hello there, Heather.
Hi, so glad to be back with you guys.
We're so glad to have one of our favorite local historians back with us.
As we were planning the next few shows, and here's, I guess, where we get into kind of the gaps in the historical record, there's lots of information to work with from 1840 on. And we have talked about as much as we can about, or, you know, of course you could talk forever about it, but we've talked about what we know about kind of the fur trade and the early exploration of the area by David Thompson and others. But there's kind of a gap between those early fur traders and the 1840s, from the time David Thompson moved on in 1812 until the 1840s. 25 years or so, and that's a long gap of time to fill.
Yeah. So two questions we were trying to answer in this show before we move on is, one, what was happening in North Idaho from around 1812 when David Thompson moved on to about 1840? And then we were also curious when Idaho became a territory and then later a state. So it was really easy to find dates to answer the second question. But to answer the first, we really have to zoom way out outside of Bonner County and then also go back in time again a little bit in order to clarify what was happening in this 25-year period of time. We're also going to ask the forgiveness of our listeners who may be history buffs. Just like the authors of the 1,200-page History of North Idaho book felt that they could not sufficiently tell its story, We will certainly not be able to touch on every important detail in the next hour. We are going to talk a lot about things that were happening at the national scale. And of course, you know, there are so many volumes on U.S. history. We won't be able to get into it all. But to begin, the period between the European discovery of North America, but before Idaho became a state or even a territory, really comes down to one European motivation and the impact it had on native populations, which was the desire to own this land.
Well, and to understand how and why European powers were fighting over the Northwest from the 16th to the 19th century, it's important to note the different views of property ownership that were at play throughout that time. So among native tribes, land was generally viewed as a shared resource. Among tribes that moved seasonally, specific resources that were on or came from the land each season could be claimed and used, but not the land itself. Tools and objects were frequently traded or given away. And under European law, land was a commodity that could be bought and sold. And individuals who owned a tract of land, for the most part, had exclusive rights to its use. Ownership was determined by formal means and recognized by deeds, contracts, and enforced by courts of law.
Yeah. So this distinction led to some of the conflict that would happen as the North American continent was being settled by Europeans. We found one primary source document from the British colonies that I think helps illustrate this point well. In 1736, Chief Sachem of the Mohegan Indians went to England to petition King George II. And we were able to find the original text from his petition. He went to England because settlers of the colony of Connecticut, who had been, as he said, freely afforded large tracts of land for their new settlements by the Mohegan people, had continued to encroach beyond the boundaries of that land until the native people were restricted to about 2 square miles of what they of the lands that they had used before that. Chief Sachem cites 2 violations that speak to the different European and Native American ideologies about land. So he said that on the one hand, the settlers had acted contrary to their public records and contrary to an official alliance with the English. So these were documents that were written down, and this was the type of thing that he knew the Europeans and King George would value. He also cited that, quote, a generation arose in the colony of Connecticut who knew not Uncas and his successors. This would have been the chief's grandfather, I believe. Indicating that the current generation of settlers did not understand or respect the relationships and verbal agreements forged between their ancestors. And these type of relationship-based agreements were the kind of thing that were valued by the tribe. And so that kind of shows that he's appealing both to the king's sense of what determined land ownership, but he's also appealing on behalf of how his people saw how land should be treated and how its use should be agreed upon. So Chief Sachem actually died of smallpox in London before his case was heard and his petition was disregarded. But it kind of gives us an idea of the type of things that were happening at the time.
Mm-hmm. I have to confess, I don't think I was familiar with this case. And and then unfortunately he died, so it didn't. Wasn't ever heard.
And it was something I was really excited to find. It was kind of used as a reference in a document Heather found talking about different conflicts in Idaho, but it was kind of cited as a case study for that.
Really helps us set the stage and understand.
Yeah. this is a time of great change. Advancements in technology over this period, particularly the relative ease with which sailing expeditions could be undertaken, got European powers in a slow simmering frenzy to discover, in quotes, and claim the New World. all of the wars and conflicts in Europe itself still commanded most of the focus of the European powers, but they would occasionally finance an expensive expedition if it meant there might be able to one-up their neighbors down the road. As reports of extensive, seemingly untapped natural resources in North America's forests trickled back to Europe, the race intensified.
So upon learning that Native Americans had no formal documented on paper system for dividing and allocating land, it became easy for European settlers to claim property rights on lands used by the tribes. Many different justifications for this were used, but two were particularly common. One was the dominion mandate from the book of Genesis in the Bible, which commands in part to, quote, fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over every living thing that moves on the earth. As Christians, I think all of Europe at this point was Christian, either Catholic or Protestant. This was a compelling reason for conquest. Secondly, the idea that because most native tribes used the land for hunting rather than for agriculture, the Europeans saw the land as it was as being unused and of little value, and therefore they believed that it could be taken or bought for a small sum. A reverend in Boston in 1722, when he was questioned about whether this type of behavior was acceptable, I believe, in the eyes of God, he said, "It is our European dwelling on it and our improvements that have made it to be of worth."
Improvement is a word you see used prominently later on in the Homestead Act in the 1860s as well. But that's a story for another episode.
Yeah.
We have differences in ideology here setting the stage for European powers to stake their claim to the land that is now Idaho. Who got to Idaho first?
Well, by 1815, the land that is now Idaho had already been claimed by the Spanish explorers in the 1500s, who basically claimed the entire continent, but never sent men into the Northwest. And then, informally by France, in the late 1600s, when French missionaries and traders were pushing westward from Quebec. In James Hockley's book, The History of Idaho from 1920 states, he states, in the early part of the 18th century, a belief existed among Europeans that somewhere there was a river that flowed into the South Sea, as then the Pacific Ocean was called. This belief was founded upon reports given to the traders by Indians familiar with the Northwest, who said that near the mouth of the river, the water was so rough that it was dangerous to pass over in canoes. The description applies well to the Columbia River, which was then unknown to the white man. So then a French man called Verdre, did I say that correctly?
Sure.
No French background, apologies, was authorized by the French officials of Canada to search for the fabled river. For 13 years, from 1731 to 1743, he wandered about in the Rocky Mountains without successfully finding the river. But as he wintered at the modern-day Yellowstone, he may have been the first European to step foot in what is now Idaho.
I thought that was really interesting.
That is.
I always assumed David Thompson was the first European.
Yes, so that is the story.
Kind of interesting. There might have been someone before.
Yes. And it's funny, you'll see a theme how people kind of wandered into Idaho, too.
Accidentally, it seems, most of the time.
At the conclusion of the French and Indian War in 1762, all French claimed land west of the Mississippi River was distributed to Spain by the British. The same land was later purchased by the United States in the Treaty of Paris in 1803. So concurrently, Russia made extensive claims in North America in 1732. And in 1824, the quote-unquote Oregon country, including modern-day Idaho, was ceded to the United States, while Russia kept Alaska until the U.S. bought it in 1867.
So a lot of people were trading this land around without ever having been here. and I'm so curious. I would love to go look at some maps from the 1700s and see how they conceptualized this part of the country, having never
grayed it out.
Been here. So before that, kind of in the middle of all of that land transfer, in 1792, a merchant expedition led by Bostonian Captain Robert Gray sailed into the mouth of the Columbia River. And this is supposed to be the first European who had done that at this point. This set off the race to find the Northwest Passage, in which David Thompson played a role and which we discussed in the last two episodes.
We talked about that in the last couple episodes, how the hunt for the Northwest Passage, the fabled Northwest Passage, the sea route to the Pacific Ocean that, if it exists, not here.
and so, like, one thing that blows my mind, kind of side note, but people didn't, the whole concept of tectonic plates was not formally accepted into modern scientific understanding until the 1970s. So obviously at this time, they did not know anything about tectonic plates. But it does strike me as curious that they thought there would be this river route that crossed the entire country. And I mean, maybe at that point, no one had really been into the Rocky Mountains to see that water would flow from either side of that. But they were just certain that there was a way through.
Right. It does seem, it seems so strange to us now with modern eyes to think that there would be there would be somewhere a river that flows east-west like that.
It's amazing how legends can grow over like a pub brew.
having them all like, yes, there must be.
Totally.
Well, it's very interesting. That's that hunt for the Northwest Passage driving a lot of the exploration of this area at the time. The French and British were the big players in the fur trade that brought people out here. How and why did the Americans become involved in this area?
So much was up in the air for the Americans at this point in time. They had just recently secured their independence from the British. On one hand, little was known about the geography and resources of the Northwest at the time, and the United States was fully occupied with the development of its East Coast and with a growing interest in the Mississippi Valley. So most Americans at that point just found the Pacific Northwest too far away to take an interest in it. This always reminds me, I grew up in the Midwest, and at this point in time, you know, it's always been odd thinking that Illinois, Indiana, even Ohio are considered part of the Midwest. But at this point, that was the West.
Yeah.
Like, you know, what was beyond that was pretty inconceivable to Americans living in Boston or Virginia.
This is do you ever, how do you define the Midwest versus the West? This is a conversation
debate I
have had often.
Okay, well, I grew up in southeastern Indiana, and we grew up being told we were part of the Midwest.
Yeah.
I knew Kentucky was not.
Yes.
Kentucky's like a floating island. It doesn't belong to any part of the country, apparently. Yeah. But I grew up knowing Ohio even as part of the Midwest. Now, I know there are those who believe that like Iowa and Nebraska are kind of
I want to hear an accent when you say that. I was like looking for that.
I have family members with accents.
I think, here's my definition of it. I'm from Minnesota and I consider myself from the Midwest as well, which is even further west than Ohio. And I think it's basically those states that were not part, that land that was not part of the original country when after the Declaration of Independence, that was added between that period and the Civil War, that was not part of the Confederacy.
So east of the Louisiana Purchase.
Yeah.
That sounds west very
of
official.
The colonies.
Yeah. So it's west of the colonies. If you came in to a territory or state during that period, you're in the Midwest,
okay.
or which at the time would have been, just been called the West.
Yeah.
And then when they started adding, especially after the Civil War, adding these new territories further to the West, that became what we now consider the old West or the, you know, the West.
That totally makes sense.
Hmm. Yeah.
I grew up so, like, focused, like, my life was around the Ohio River Valley area. So in my mind as a kid, it was always like the Ohio River people and then the Great Lakes people up north who seemed very glamorous at the time.
Oh, that's so fun.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's our digression on the Midwest. And all I know is Idaho is not part of the Midwest.
Correct. I think we can all agree on that.
Yeah. Yes, go on. Who did I interrupt?
Well, on the other hand, the British were aggressively exploring into the West, and the prospect of potentially facing the British on two sides was probably a little uncomfortable. So we won't touch on Lewis and Clark much because this story is so well known. But by sending them into the American West, President Jefferson was asserting the U.S. defiance once again. By 1812, the United States and Britain were back at war over trade disputes and desires to expand into the West. The War of 1812 ended in a stalemate.
Yeah. Though relatively scant records tell us about the history of Idaho at this time, the United States at large was undergoing enormous change. The period we're investigating from 1815 to 1849, which is called the antebellum era at the national level, was marked by significant changes to the U.S. political party system, explosive growth in communication and infrastructure technologies, and a widespread revival of religious fervor in the Second Great Awakening. Westward expansion became the rallying cry of U.S. politicians, particularly Andrew Jackson, the president of the United States from 1829 to 1837. The Jacksonians favored expansion across the continent, which they called manifest destiny, the idea that it was God's will that the U.S. basically take over the entire North American continent and remove all of the Native Americans from it. So Manifest Destiny dispossessed American Indians of lands in favor of European farmers, planters, and slaveholders.
So, I mean, that's all certainly an interesting story, as we well know. But what was happening here in North Idaho at this time? Where many, many thousands of miles from the action in Washington, D.C.
Well, we had to dig deep, and I'm sorry to say, but not a lot in North Idaho at this point, or at least documented back to what we were saying originally.
Right.
As far as settlement was concerned, that's kind of what was happening, not a lot. But important developments were happening down south around the Snake River. So the 1996 book, Rocks, Rails, and Trails, published by the Idaho State University Press, tells us that while David Thompson was establishing trading posts in our area for the British Crown, the American Missouri Fur Company was working its way west along the Snake River, setting up a prominent post called Fort Henry. And at the same time, American fur merchant John Jacob Astor... Wasn't he on the Titanic?
Yes.
Okay.
I believe he was.
Let's see, that's what I was thinking, too. And then I was like, he would be too old. It must have been his son.
A relative.
Okay,
yeah.
Yeah. Family.
There,
yeah,
was
right?
a, there was a famous Astor who died on the Titanic.
Yes. Yeah.
I had the same thought, and then I did not research it thoroughly.
The more famous for founding Fort Astoria at the mouth of the Columbia, he also commissioned the overland expedition to the coast by the way of the Snake River. And isn't that funny that he made this pivotal mark and we know that last name because of the Titanic?
Yeah.
In the War of 1812, the British acquired Fort Astoria, and thereafter, most trading posts were west of the Rockies, and they were maintained by the Hudson Bay Company until the 1850s. When the fur trade went out of favor for mining. So the Hudson Bay Company even trapped out the Snake River Valley to establish a barren zone so Americans couldn't successfully trap in the area again.
Mm-hmm. Oh, they basically just trapped everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's we'll get them, right?
Yeah.
That's just crazy. Some individual Americans defied British authority and continued to live and trap in Idaho's wilderness, leading to the folklore of the Mountain Man. These men became valuable guides during the transition from the fur trade era to mining and railroad eras that would soon follow. Hmm. That's interesting.
Yeah. Because I feel like even now we hear this, like, this idea of the Mountain Man.
Oh, yeah. History Channel has brought it back, for sure.
As this figure of folklore. And I never knew where that came from.
Well, flannel and beard.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
This was, it. Let's see, it's in this time. From I'm interjecting here, but in this time I know is when they settle on the 49th parallel.
Yes.
Basically. Mm-hmm. Yeah, as the dividing line. So that's when mm-hmm. Idaho actually becomes officially, or this part of Idaho officially becomes part of the United States and not part of Canada.
1846 is when that was definitively decided.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So up until that point, there mm-hmm. were still both parties at play.
Okay.
In the 1830s, mm-hmm. a wealthy young man from Cambridge, Massachusetts, named Nathaniel Wyeth, ignored his father's wishes for him to go to Harvard and instead embarked upon a series of disastrous expeditions into the Northwest. I can just see this as like this, you know, well-off young man. His dad's like, of course you're going to Harvard to become a lawyer like me. And he's like, no, I'd rather just go off into the wilderness. And his dad's like, fine, get it out of your system. I'll fund your expedition.
Yeah.
And then he never comes home.
Oh, no. It's like, no, man. No, dad, I want to be a mountain man.
Yeah. So despite shipwreck, rough winters, and the aggressions of the Hudson Bay Company, Wyeth managed to establish Fort Hall in southern Idaho. Wyeth's was the first expedition to include missionaries on the crew, though it's unclear if they did much proselytizing. I found this so interesting. He even wrote in his journals that he at one point visited the site of David Thompson's Kalispell House in 1833, reporting that at the time it was nothing but, quote, a pile of logs and falling chimney stones.
Hmm.
So we learn that, you know, Kalispell House was already falling mm-hmm. apart at that point in time. I also had no idea that anyone had come up here to see it that mm-hmm. early on.
Yeah.
So super interesting.
Thank goodness that people journaled back then.
Yeah. I did mm-hmm. also allude to him dying. He did not. He went back to Boston and, had a normal older age.
Gave up, went back to Boston. That is, so yeah. I had no idea that we've talked about how Thompson's Kalispell House, the first mm-hmm. Permanent structure built by Europeans anyway in Idaho,
mm-hmm.
Which is over on the Hope Peninsula here in our listening area.
Yes.
Was lost more or less for like 100, or after he left it,
yeah. mm-hmm.
nobody knew where mm-hmm. it was for like 100 years.
Right.
But this guy did.
Well, he and this, it. Yeah, and this uh-huh. goes back to this idea of how do we learn from history mm-hmm. at that mm-hmm. point in time? So say when these guys were writing that big history book in 1903, they didn't mm-hmm. have the internet. They mm-hmm. didn't have any, you know, previously compiled history of Idaho. So they were going to places like Portland or Boston mm-hmm. to track down original journals, original primary source documents that people had written about the area. So when they wrote that, they had no idea that Wyeth had been up here. That was something that I found in a newspaper article from 1915. So at that point in time, they had discovered Wyeth's journals. Someone mm-hmm. up here had and put those pieces together. But there are lots of gaps depending on
yeah.
where information is stored.
I feel like that's like a whole show in itself. Like, who are the people that did that book of 1903 and what yeah. was their adventure like?
Right.
Yeah.
That's so fascinating.
And I want to know what happened to the house, to Kalispell House. A pile of logs and fallen chimney stones mm-hmm.
they
at the
just,
time.
Yeah, they basically, Thompson abandoned it mm-hmm. because Thompson Falls in Montana and yeah. then Spokane House.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then there was another one further west just were more productive.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And they were so temporary that I imagine, you know, he probably didn't put much into it when he was putting it up and
mm-hmm.
yeah.
And just disused, yeah, brought
fell
it down.
Apart. Yep.
Blew down in the winter. Yeah. Interesting. Okay.
So the Hudson Bay Company established Fort Boise and ultimately took over Weiss Fort Hall. Both forts became sites known for rendezvous in addition to Pierre Hole's near present day Teton. Oh my gosh.
Tetonia.
Thank you.
In the valley west of the Tetons. Yeah.
Missouri businessman General William Henry Ashley popularized the rendezvous system in 1825. So this is such an interesting history. So it was a scheme that replaced permanent trading posts, which saved them money.
Mm-hmm,
so the rendezvous was a combination of fair, circus, and rodeo. So it was a time of feasting, drinking, carousing, and a contest of skills.
And this is, I'm not sure, but it makes me wonder, I think previous to this, trading posts had mostly been like one kind of fur trading operation, say David Thompson's, meeting with the local tribes to trade.
Mm-hmm.
The way that they describe this, it sounds more like different fur trapping groups were getting together.
Slash Chautauqua.
Yeah. And so they were kind of like showing off to each other.
Yeah. It's like someone had this marketing idea and a way to save money and ..
The rendezvous system. So they pick a place and they we'll meet there and then.
Bring all the trappers to one location. Huh. How they get the word out to these guys who are way up in the hills.
That's
an
interesting question.
Unless it's just like put out a flyer 4 years from now, we will meet
exactly.
And hope that they see it sometime along the way
by pack mule.
Yeah.
Well, and the interesting thing is rendezvous are still super popular in today's time. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if there was ever like a pause on that and now it's just popular because of.
Is it popular in a reenactment sense?
Yes.
Or as in a like actual trappers are getting together?
I would be speaking from a reenactment.
Okay.
Like people wanting to be like that.
Gotcha.
But like I have these adorable retired neighbors that's like their big thing, or like going to rendezvous and trying to also acquire like original like pieces.
Oh,
and then there's certain people that are the traders amongst like those rarities for the rendezvous guard.
So it's kind of like a niche, antique.
Yeah.
Kind of trading.
Costuming though too, right?
Right, right.
Yeah. So it's a combination of all of it. Huh. Yeah.
So that's kind of the end of in the rendezvous scheme, the rendezvous system that it was popular. It worked.
Mm-hmm.
I mean that and overtook the trading post plan, I guess.
At least in Southern Idaho.
It'd be amazing if there were some photos from that time period.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So then at this time, everything's kind of in flux in Idaho. Are there any permanent settlement in this area at the time? And like when did settlers start moving in?
Yeah. So really these forts that we've been talking about are the only real permanent settlements. And like Heather was just saying, they may not have been as permanent, you know, if they were being replaced by this rendezvous system. But we did have Fort Boise and Fort Hall down in the Snake River Valley. Those were kind of the only spots that people stayed. But what would become the biggest influences on the settlement of Idaho by what we think of as settlers in the mid-1800s? It comes down to three primary factors. One was the work of the missionaries. Two is mining. Three is the Oregon Trail. So we're going to focus on the first two in upcoming episodes when we zoom back in on Bonner County. But while we're thinking about Idaho in the early days, before it was even a territory, much less a state, let's talk a little bit about the Oregon Trail, because it is important.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not the video game we all...
Oh, I love that game.
That was like one of the first video games for the computers back in school, right?
Mm-hmm. Computer games are so much better than like an Xbox. I just gotta say it.
Definitely. Oh.
Now, that's another program.
We'll have my son on for that one.
Okay.
So when the fur trade industry deteriorated in the 1840s, Idaho had become less desirable as a source of furs, mainly due to the overtrapping. So Idaho, lacking good farmland or discovered mineral wealth, was totally undesirable as a place to settlement to the pioneers moving west around this time. However, there were areas eagerly sought after by settlers and miners in Oregon and California to the west. And I think it's due to the Ice Age floods, by the way.
Yeah, we talked about how the good soil got washed into the Willamette Valley.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. The final expansion of the United States westward across the entire continent was all about to begin.
I'm going to jump in real quick, just because I think it's kind of confusing that these early explorers like Captain Gray and so forth were basically avoiding this whole process because they would just sail all the way around the tip of South America, back up the Pacific coast, and land at Astoria or land in the Puget Sound and create these settlements there. The people coming from the colonies were trying to go to the same places, the coast of California, Oregon, Washington. So why were they traveling overland to do this? And I think the only answer is the cost, probably, that these expeditions were so expensive. And you could only hold, like, I don't know, probably 40 to 100 people on any given ship. And the demand, I think, was probably too high to do it by ship.
I also think it was the allure of the mountain man, don't you think? Versus, like, being a sailor.
I feel like that allure was quashed pretty quickly for the people doing this. But
also,
go on.
I must say, because I don't think we've covered this, but David Thompson, and maybe you guys did in the previous episodes, he was the first person to document seeing Bigfoot.
This is a huge divergence. I have another theory that he, rather than see, I think we got into this with Jack Nisbet.
But potentially
David Thompson saw some like petrified sort of mammoth footprint, tracks. And then he had heard these stories about elephants over in Asia and Africa. And then he like was talking about this, you know, giant woolly mammoth type of thing. And then from that, the Bigfoot story extrapolated.
Are you debunking Bigfoot?
No, I'm considering how he evolved from the mammoth.
That does.
But this is quite the divergence.
Yeah, but pretty amazing.
Yeah. I didn't know that.
I think it was 1852.
We did talk a little bit about mammoths with, when we talked to Jack Nisbet, but we didn't talk about Bigfoot, as I recall, at all.
Oh, I wrote that for a while in terms of, like, letting that be the validity for using Bigfoot in all of the wayfinding.
But you had talked about him finding Bigfoot, and then we talked with Jack about him finding some evidence of mammoths, and I'm like, one's big and hairy, the other's big and hairy.
Yeah, no, it's true.
There's got to be a link here.
I'd always love to think that there's that moment of magic out there that science can't debunk.
We'll come back to that. You may have an original theory there.
I should have researched it more thoroughly before sharing.
It's official.
Right. Yeah, what if that's the origin of Bigfoot is as a woolly mammoth? What if?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Everybody thinks he's a primate.
I mean, we're still discovering new species every day. Mm-hmm. So, and the Northwest is big still, right? And vast. Well, back to 1832, Captain Bonneville led the first crossing of the Rocky Mountains in covered wagons. So this is where we're talking about the final expansion of the United States. In 1836, Narcissa Whitman and Eliza Spaulding were the first white women to cross the Continental Divide. I find this really interesting, particularly for this one part coming up. So Eliza and her husband, Henry S. Spaulding, established a mission near Lapua, where they printed the Northwest's first book. They established Idaho's first school, and they developed Idaho's first irrigation system. But, okay, drum roll, please, drum roll. And they grew the state's first potatoes.
Right? Of course.
Yeah. So that goes down in history.
1836.
Yeah.
Okay. So those were some of the first people to... So those were the first people to come over on the Oregon Trail and decide to stay in Idaho.
Got it. Yeah. So... Do you know where they immigrated from?
I don't.
And where did the potatoes come from, too? I mean, that would be really interesting.
Right. Did they bring them with them?
Yeah, because I always find that so fascinating how people immigrated over with seeds
that and they were established.
Animals and
yep. They're like, this worked in Sweden, so it will work here. Mm-hmm. And then they find out whether it does or not.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll have to do a little more digging on their backstory.
Yeah. The Spaldings and the first potatoes in Idaho.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
So although primarily associated with Oregon, a segment of the Oregon Trail passed through southern Idaho, bringing pioneers westward. After being included in the United States territory, like Jack was saying, in 1846, upon settlement of the northern boundary with Canada, Fort Hall developed as an important supply station for emigrants through the 1850s on the Oregon Trail. It was located at the end of the common 500-mile stretch from the east, shared by the three far west emigrant trails. Soon after Fort Hall, the Oregon and California trails diverged in northwesterly and southwesterly directions. An estimated 270,000 emigrants reached Fort Hall on their way west, but it would be another 30 or so years until Bonner County up north was permanently settled.
Wow.
We should note that at the time of the Oregon Trail, modern-day Idaho, as well as Oregon and Washington, they were not states, and they were all part of what? The Oregon Territory.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So when they say the Oregon Trail, it really could mean people are heading to modern-day Oregon, Washington, or Idaho. And of the 400,000 people who started this journey from back east, it's unclear how many of the only 80,000 emigrants who eventually settled in the Oregon Territory stayed in what is now Idaho. It's thought that the potential for cultivating crops in the arid Snake River Valley was overlooked, like you said, in favor of the rich farmland of the Willamette Valley near the coast. Okay, so another slight divergence, but even though we'll dive into mining in more detail in an upcoming episode, Heather found this fascinating tidbit about how mining influenced not only emigration at the time, but also the borders of the Northwest Territories. We've touched a little bit on how the territory boundaries were changing over this period of time, but this was just so fascinating. Yes.
So from the period of 1848 to 1864, modern-day Idaho was reshaped by six different territorial boundaries designed by the United States Congress. So in 1848, the Oregon Territory, as we were discussing, was outlined. And then in 1853, modern-day Oregon was split off, leaving Idaho as part of the Washington Territory. At that time, scarcely anyone was expected to live in Idaho until sometime in the 20th century, and Congress anticipated no need for further boundary revision for another 50 years.
So they just, they probably, the people who traveled through were just like, Idaho is,
like, yep, we'll just keep cruising.
Yep.
But in 1860, gold was discovered in the Nez Perce country, which changed that pattern of settlement in the Washington Territory abruptly. So it's amazing how that moment in time just changed it all, right? So by 1862, there was a higher population of miners in the Idaho area than there were over on the Washington coast. And unless the mines were put into a new territory, political control of Washington was about to move from Puget Sound to the new Idaho mining region.
I can just imagine the people in Seattle thinking they're ever so civilized and like aristocratic, like we cannot give power to the miners.
Furthermore, in 1862, offshoot of the Idaho gold excitement brought the beginning of mining to the upper Missouri in an area just east of the Continental Divide in what then was the western extremity of Dakota.
Okay.
So here also, no one could doubt that the gold rush would shift the balance of population from eastern to the western edge of the territory.
Ah, so the same thing was happening in the Dakota.
Exactly. Okay. So the creation of the new enormous territory of Idaho on March 4th, 1863, provided the answer. So this action gave the miners a government of their own and saved control of Washington and of Dakota for those who lived in the older sections of those territories.
Okay. So they're just like basically cutting chunks of those off and then mushing them together.
Exactly. Okay. But the only trouble was that the original territory of Idaho, with an area decidedly larger than that of Texas, had three active mining regions, each separated from the others by formidable mountain barriers.
Okay.
So communication within such a territory, especially when the legislature met only during the winter, proved to be almost impossible.
Huh. It's interesting to me that these miners, who I always think of as kind of temporary residents, they like go in, mine, get out, that they would be participating in government.
Oh, yeah.
At that time. But I guess they have a lot of stake.
Yeah. So the eastern Idaho mines were made into Montana in 1864. And finally, with the building of the Union Pacific Railway across the continent, Wyoming was created in 1868. That action, incidentally, provided Idaho with territorial boundaries that turned out to be permanent.
It's interesting that those were established in... Well, I need to clarify this. If that means Montana and Wyoming were becoming states...
This is where we need to see the map.
We need to see the map.
Yeah.
Because it's so interesting to me that Idaho, of all of those, seems to be the very last that got statehood.
Yeah.
I might be wrong.
I think you're right. Wyoming might have come later. I think Idaho Idaho got its... Here, I can tell you the date. You know
Jack's
the date.
The real national history he really expert is. Here.
Okay.
But again, like power and money, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is what is really shifting and forming everything, which is still relevant today.
Yeah, but you can imagine all the little like side conversations happening of like, we can't let them get control of.
Yes. And again, like I always go back, and I know you do too, to like the handlebar mustaches and the in the room, just citing everyone's face.
Yeah, and it's so easy. I think also because of how many gaps there are in this Western history for these kind of archetypes to be created that we see in the Western films of like the supervillain and the like hero, and it's so easy because we just, I mean, I'm sure all of these people. We're just as complex as we are today, but 100%. When you don't know all the details,
that's when the storytelling
turn them into characters. Yeah, exactly.
It went the order went Montana was 1889, Washington 1889 as well, right after Montana, and then about 9 months later, Idaho in 1890 became the 43rd state admitted to the Union. And Wyoming came a week after that.
Oh, interesting.
Okay. Yeah. So they were doing it all around the same time.
Yeah.
So these must have been territorial determinations.
It was like on back the, in the to-do list. We'll just clean this whole thing up at the same time.
Yeah. Get it done in one legislative session.
Yeah. Very interesting. This is a question I didn't think to ask before we kind of started preparing for the show, but why is this part of Idaho where we sit? The far northern part of Idaho. Why is the panhandle part of Idaho not part of either Washington or Montana?
I think we should do a whole episode down the road about how the boundaries of the panhandle itself were determined. Because there are some good stories there as well.
Yeah, and understandably, because it's such a vast topic, when you're in your formidable education years, you don't spend a lot of time understanding boundaries, right? It's like, this is my state. This is what we're known for.
Sure.
Yeah. But the panhandle is so much like Oregon and Washington.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We're kind of just, we're so different. It's like, no, we're not known for potatoes. We're known for our amazing natural resources, our lakes and ski mountains. And
yeah. So I think we'll have to do a whole great idea. Episode about boundaries.
Indeed.
Taking a closer look.
Yeah. So these boundaries.
And who did it? Like, I imagine, like, they're looking at a map. They're like, what if we did this? Would you be okay with that? You know, like, under negotiations.
Yeah. Who divided it up? Who were the people who said, this part's Idaho, this part's Montana, this part's Wyoming? I don't know. Curiouser and curiouser. Let's see. Well, we have about 8 minutes left here. Have we come to a conclusion of sorts?
I think for now.
We told the story?
Our goal was to fill this gap of time.
Mm-hmm.
Our goal was to zoom out a little bit and look at what was happening at the national, international level. Understanding that, you know, I am certainly no expert on national history, but even
learning every day.
County history, we're all learning. So, but getting a taste of some of the things at play that would later influence how this area specifically was settled.
Mm-hmm. Well, interesting. Okay.
And we found some new people that were some of the first supposedly where we thought it was David Thompson, which was kind of fun.
Verendry.
Yes.
The Frenchman, whose name I'm sure I'm mispronouncing.
And the Astor family is just way more than the Titanic going down
to. And I had associated them with Astoria, but I never knew they did an overland expedition.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we learned a lot today.
Super fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Where does that leave us? This area, North Idaho, the area that we talk about, we've kind of come up to about the middle of the 1800s, the middle of the 19th century, right? Who was, at this time, the people who were here were, what, miners down in the Silver Valley? And
not even yet.
No?
Well, I guess it gets a little fuzzy as we,
yeah.
So, yes. But up here in Bonner County, we have the, you know, native tribes.
Mm-hmm.
We have occasional fur trappers coming through the area.
Mm-hmm.
And then what we're going to get into in the next episode is when the Jesuit missionaries start to come through.
Cool. Okay. Yeah.
And we'll see what they were doing and the impact it had and what it led to.
The cultural, definition of the state as well, the area. I will mention at this time that we have reached out, thought it was important to reach out to the Kalispell tribe, and we are looking forward to, at some point in the future, having a representative of them, hopefully onto these airwaves, or at least working in conjunction with them to kind of produce, as we tell the early history of the area, that is certainly not something we want to overlook, and in fact, it's really central to the whole to the whole development of the area, but it's not something we want to wander into without their guidance, I don't think. So look forward to that when we can make it work with all of our schedules, I think. No specific date on that. So next month we're talking Father Desmet, the Jesuit missionary.
Yes.
Is that your plan?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Cool.
And some of the other guys he worked with.
Okay. Yeah. Well, how very exciting.
Yes.
let's talk about what's happening at the museum right now.
Yeah. So on May 3rd, that's this coming Saturday, if you are listening to this the first time it airs.
Mm-hmm.
But every first Saturday of the month, we do free admission. The museum is open from 10 until 2. And in May, it is sponsored by Shirley Parker. Thank you, Shirley. And we also will have hands-on history activities for kids sponsored by Julie Smith this month. So if you're around, again, admission is free on the first Saturday of each month. We also have some upcoming events, and we're going to get these updated on our website soon. But we will be doing a weekly summer walking tour of downtown Sandpoint. We're going to have a big membership picnic this summer, and we are bringing our yard sale back for the end of summer. Heather remembers the yard sale.
Yes.
So if you have some things set aside to get rid of, doing your spring cleaning, and you don't want to throw your own yard sale, you can hold on to those and donate them to the museum, and that will be we're bringing it back this year. It's a lot of fun. I also just want to say thank you. I know a couple of weeks ago, people in the community generously donated to both the museum and to KRFY through the Live Give 7B campaign hosted by the Inovia Foundation. Mm-hmm. So thank you to everyone who supported us. That all goes into helping us do amazing programs like this.
Thank you very much indeed. Yes, it helped. KRFY was the beneficiary of some generosity then as well. A successful campaign that Live Give 70.
Yeah, that was really special.
It is, we do have probably just enough time. Is this a question for you, Hannah?
I think it's a question for everyone. I didn't know if we'd have some extra time to fill.
Okay. What is one thing from local history you want to research or learn this year?
Me?
Let's start with Hannah. You must have put some thought into this.
This is very specific. If you've been to the library anytime in, I don't know how many years, in the children's area, there's this amazing bear that's painted like lots of different famous works of art.
Oh.
I recently was digging through the museum archives and found these photos of all of these similar bear sculptures that were all decorated in fantastic ways. My favorite is one that was tricked out like a giant disco ball bear. But there were about a dozen of them. I have no record on why they were created, for what event. It seems like they were made in the 1980s. And I have found three of them that are still around in the community. But if you know why these bears were created or where any of them may still exist,
I feel like that's
my pet project.
A Carol Diener question.
Ooh, yeah. We'll have to get in touch with
the great
ladies of art.
Interesting, because there was a movement that happened, I feel like. Let's rewind the clock here in 2000. Early 2000s, I was a young student at University of Oregon. So in Eugene, we had the Oregon Ducks.
Oh.
So we had these casts of ducks that were just like the bears. Uh-huh. And then each artist was commissioned to paint one.
Right.
Or do some sort of creative work with it.
Like, I'm from Cincinnati and we have flying pigs.
Yeah, and there's like moose. So totally. I think it was like this big like artist initiative that happened. And then I want to believe that they were like auctioned off.
Mm-hmm.
And then the money went to like different organizations.
Yeah.
And then like I worked at this really fabulous boutique in a historic downtown area, and we had a beautiful designer one right outside our retail door. Sure. And so, and then you could like find each one.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So don't you think it was probably part of that?
It had to be part of something like that.
Yeah.
So what do you want to research this year?
Oh, gosh. I think I'm going to throw that one to Jack really quickly.
I'm top of my head here. I'm interested in something that it sounds like you guys already have figured out, but figuring out why we are Idaho and why we are not Montana and why we are not Washington here. This particular part, I don't know. I'm curious. It seems like you would... I don't know.
That's a lot more relevant to what we're talking about.
I love like the artist inquiry though. Well, and then for me, it's like I always think about who are the people that did like the regions and like did this big decision making, the movers and the shakers. Like, where did they come from and how did they come about? Mm-hmm. So I'll piggyback on with you, Jack. It's like, and I think like I just came off of having the opportunity to go see Hamilton, you know? And so like we find out a little bit more into like who these people were. And I think that's just me kind of buzzing off of that moment.
Well, this has been the Community Character Hour. I think we're coming to the end here. Tune in next month for more. Tentatively, at least, we're talking about Jesuit missionary Father DeSmit and his expedition out here, and his impact on the area, also strong. And do we have a sign-off? Is there anything I say at the end? Just goodbye?
Until next time.
Okay. Stay tuned for Bird Note and then Otto's Eclectic Mix all day long here on 88.5 KRFY. This is Panhandle Community Radio. Thank you very much, Hannah Combs, Executive Director of the Bonner County Historical Society and Museum.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Heather Upton. What did we decide your title is? Local historian?
Just me.
Okay. Right. How does one say it? Obtainer of rare antiquities.
Yeah, I've kind of done a lot with the little history moment there. So.
Okay. And I'm Jack Peterson. And like I said, stay tuned for Bird Note coming up next.